to Gonkcast, a long-form discussion podcast about the music of English electronic duo Autechre, album by album, EP by EP. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this episode, we are continuing our mostly chronological run through Autechre's Odds and Ends, but stepping slightly outside our usual wheelhouse by discussing both of Warp's Artificial Intelligence compilations, Artificial Intelligence and Artificial Intelligence 2, from 1992 and 1994, respectively. And not just Autechre's contributions. We're diving deep into the Artificial Intelligence comps in full. I gotta apologize for the delay on this episode. It's funny because we were going to record last week and let you know that we had to take this week off, but then our plans got shuffled around and we had to take last week off instead. So break's already over. Next week, we'll do another listener email episode. If you haven't already, send us your thoughts on Artificial Intelligence 1 and 2, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. The week after that, we're going to embark on a major chapter of Autechre's Odds and Ends Guestcom. I'm not 100% sure how we'll divide it up or if we'll even cover every single Guestcom release or what, but the basic plan is to discuss the earlier Guestcom stuff in one episode and the later Guestcom stuff in another. We'll give you the specific details soon, but the point is, if you've got thoughts on anything Guestcom, we want to hear them. Again, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. All right, Dan, there's more background info on these historic releases than we could ever hope to cover here, but why don't you give us the basics on the first Artificial Intelligence comp, and we'll get to the second one a little later.
Yeah, Warp Records only had a handful of releases under its belt before launching the Artificial Intelligence series with a compilation called Artificial Intelligence on July 6th, 1992. Happy belated birthday. Famously, the record claims to present an entirely new kind of electronic music for an explicitly non-club setting. The cover depicts an android at home listening to Pink Floyd and Kraftwerk, and the back reads, "Are you sitting comfortably? Artificial Intelligence is electronic listening music for long journeys, quiet nights, and club drowsy dawns. Artificial Intelligence is the first in a series of listening albums from Warp." Instead of electronic listening music, however, the press called the new genre intelligent dance music, and that widely hated name persists to this day. In a 2016 interview, Sean Booth explains, "At the time, we were transitioning from doing techno kind of dancey music into tracks to listen to at home. It wasn't about saying this is intelligent and that isn't. It wasn't about being elitist, just trying to pick out the tracks that were good for a certain context." He continues, "There was a definite tongue-in-cheek thing going on with the AI series initially. Everyone knew it was a bit silly, but we were enjoying doing it. Thing is, almost all the artists on that first compilation are just like us. They were regular kids. They're not intelligent people, particularly Richard D. James is a fucking blagger, whatever that is. Richie Houghton, too. I don't know how the fuck he gets away with the things he does. Alex Patterson, people like that, they're not known for being intellectually powerful. They're just fucking good musicians."
On that note, we're not going to get into every artist's backstory today, but just in case you aren't super familiar with the comp and are looking at the wiki page right now wondering why you haven't heard of anyone, I'll just note that the Dice Man is Richard D. James, Musicology is B12, IAO is the Black Dog, or Plaid, as some people might know them when they kind of divvied up. They have pretty confusing discography. Up is Richie Houghton, who you might know as Plastic Man, possibly. And Alex Patterson is from The Orb. So there are a bunch of serious future heavyweights here. Also, the record sleeve has these neat mini interviews with all the artists, and I recommend looking them up, but we're an Autechre podcast, so I just want to read a few of their quotes. When asked why they contributed to the comp, Sean and Rob says, "There aren't enough people pushing new and original electronic music." And when asked what's next for the genre, they say, "When people run dry copying each other, a deeper, more creative music will emerge, where ideas and originality will play a major role." Lastly, I don't think it matters that much because at this point, this comp is more of a historical document than a thing people are listening to all the time, but it currently has a fairly respectable 3.58 on Rate Your Music. Real quick, though, what is your sense of this comp's reputation nowadays, Dan? Am I right in saying that most people sort of treat it like a historical document rather than some kind of classic record in itself?
I think you are right in saying it, saying that. That's the impression I seem to get, you know. You know, people in the circles, you know, we hang out or whatever, you know, mention the two Autechre tracks. But outside of that, yeah, just sort of always hear it as like, you know, this beginning of, you know, electronic listening music or intelligent dance music, whichever one you want to use. So yeah, I sort of always hear of it in the document way more.
Yeah, it seems like this kind of thing that people, I don't know, they kind of just read about and like decide that they don't really need to check it out, you know, firsthand. And obviously we'll talk about that more, but you know, it's just kind of like, I don't know, it's something everybody seems to know, but I just have this like feeling that nobody's like bumping it, you know, driving around bumping it or anything like that. What though is your personal history with this compilation?
Yeah, I mean, my history is a little bit of that, you know. I've talked about it. I love listening to albums. I'm not a singles guy. And because of that, I usually don't really like compilations because, you know, it's a mishmash of different artists most of the time. It kind of doesn't flow like a record. So maybe to my own detriment, oftentimes like, you know, skip over those kind of things, especially like a label, you know, the label sampler is usually not, something that's you know really in my wheelhouse. So you know, I've always knew about this as sort of that historical document. We talked about, you know, the Autechre tracks on a listener email, so I had listened to it, you know, in the past for that podcast. But pretty much just mostly knew about it on a intellectual level, more than a auditory one.
Yeah, I came to it pretty late, honestly. Probably just like, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, even like after I'd already, you know, digested like a huge chunk of the history of electronic music myself. And, you know, I think I had always heard of it. And then I think it was honestly, this is lame, but like Pitchfork made this really bad list of like the best IDM albums of all time. And that was on there. And I was like, really? You know, like that the comp I've always read about. And so I was like, I guess I better listen to it. And I was sort of disappointed to find that I knew a lot of the tracks from other places and stuff like that already. So yeah, just not a lot of like personal bonding with this, but this was definitely like these past, what, 3 weeks we've spent on this is like by far the most time I've spent with it.
Yeah.
Now, I went back and forth on whether we should start with the music itself or the broader context. And honestly, I think it makes sense to start with the pitch, you know, the mission statement, which is how most people would approach this record anyway. For example, several listeners more or less started their emails by talking about the artwork, like listener Joe, who wrote, "This is still one of my favorite works by the Designers Republic, and I love how it sums up the music so perfectly. Music that's meant to be enjoyed sitting in an easy chair on a good stereo, zoning out by robots, of course. Although I can see people thinking it's too cheesy and in your face with the concept, I think it's great. I love the color scheme as well as the fonts and the overall design." And listener Steve, who wrote, "The atmosphere created with the cover art perfectly describes this compilation. Of course, the back cover also announces this album as a new kind of electronic music, electronic listening music rather than electronic dance music. So what do you think about the artwork here, and how do you feel about just the overall presentation, you know, the mission statement and everything?"
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the artwork today looks a bit dated, you know. It is like 92 CGI. It reminds me of there was like some show, I think it was called like Reboot or something, where it was like they were they were like in a computer, and it looks just like cover. I mean, it's definitely like a good cover for this record, you know. It's describing like exactly, you know, they're changing this world of electronic music, you know, taking it out of the club and into the living room. So what better way than to like literally, you know, show somebody sitting in a living room, you know, listening to this music, and then, you know, putting those records on the ground, you know, Audubon and Dark Side of the Moon. It's you know, those are sort of bands, records that you associate with like, you know, chilling out, listening on the stereo kind of thing. I think it's, you know, masterfully done, if not, you know, slightly dated, but even sort of dated in that retro futuristic sort of way, you know.
Yeah, it's got sort of like a cool almost vintage look to it, I think, with like the computer generated animation and everything. But it's just such a like striking, I think, bold, awesome artwork, and just the whole presentation kind of is like you mentioned, like putting it in the living room, which is kind of, I think, in 1992, the last place you would expect to, you know, see electronic music placed, right? And, you know, we'll talk about more about those records in a minute, but just like you know, it's quite bold, I think, to put electronic music on the same pedestal as records like Dark Side of the Moon and stuff. You know, that's quite awesome. But also, you know, you got The Robot, which is like kind of funny and tongue-in-cheek in the way that I think Sean was trying to describe, but also, I don't know, quite futuristic. It just feels like this kind of thing that would be really, really striking and, I don't know, just bold. It's got like almost like a punk spirit in a weird, ironic way, just in the sense of like, this is a different kind of music. And I like that boldness. Now, listener Joe also asked, I was wondering what you thought of The Robot's taste in music. Audubon is probably my least favorite of the classic Kraftwerk albums, but I know it has many fans. I know at least Dan isn't a fan of Pink Floyd, but Animals is one of my favorite albums of all time. And although I think Dark Side of the Moon is definitely overrated, there's a perfectly legitimate reason why it's so famous. I should also mention that listener Joe and listener Steve also clued us in on the fact that the last LP is Warp's first compilation, Pioneers of the Hypnotic Groove. Joe adds, it's interesting to take a look at the releases they put out before AI1 to remember that they were once so heavily involved in the kind of rave music that IDM was a transition away from or an evolution from. So what do you think about these albums? You already started to get into it, but do you have more thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think they're good representations of the setting, you know, we're creating here. As far as what the listener said, yeah, I agree. I Audubon's not my favorite, classic Kraftwerk record either. But even though I don't like this, the second cover, you know, the one that's on this one, I prefer the original. But this one's, you know, much more obvious of, you know, what that album is. You know, it's like iconography. The same thing with Dark Side of the Moon. You know, those are records you don't have to see the label. You don't have to, see the artist name written on it. You see those, you know, little things on a CD size, you know, thing. You know what they are. I hate Pink Floyd. I hate Dark Side of the Moon. But you know, I get it. I think it's actually a good record to choose for this cover because of what I said a minute ago. You know, it's a instantly recognizable record that is known for, you know, listening in the living room. You know, like Dark Side of the Moon is a living room kind of record. So I think it is a good choice.
Yeah, it's kind of like the epitome of like the kind of, you know, early 70s, but also started in sort of the late 60s. This kind of revolution where it was like, you need to listen closely, you know, you need to pay attention. There's lots of details to figure out and stuff. And so it's just such a, I don't know, it's a cool, very bold thing, again, to just say, you should treat this the way you treat Pink Floyd. You know, it's just so funny because if you think back about like, you know, the Beatles albums like Sgt. Pepper's and stuff, that was like making this big statement like, hey, you should think of pop music the same way you think of art. And that was like really revolutionary.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of doing it again in their own way, but like interestingly using the music that is now canon, you know, to put themselves in the same canon. You know, listener Ella also asked this question on the topic of Pink Floyd, sort of. You know, Ella brought up the common associations, I think, at the time between IDM and drug culture. And Pitchfork's review makes a similar comment saying, Warp envisioned a post-rave head session, a time for contemplative and cerebral journey into music's future. A bit hippie, isn't it? Does that help explain the Pink Floyd choice? Do you get those similar vibes from like this record and the way it's presented and everything? Is, you know, something like a drug related kind of come down thing?
I guess I've never really done drugs, so I don't know, you know, the feeling after a rave or something, but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Dark Side of the Moon is a like record that I think a lot of people associate with, you know, drugs and everything. So again, it's again a good record to pick for that, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, just like more generally, you know, I think that around this time there was like just a big, you know, it kind of had this like stink on it, the sort of electronic listening music thing, which was like, this is music for people who are like too high to dance anymore or whatever. They're like, they came home and they're like, they got to come down off something or whatever. And, you know, there are certain records, like maybe this is controversial, but I feel like Dark Side of the Moon, right, almost like kind of leans into this, like, you know, there are probably better examples, but just like, yeah, you should take drugs and listen to this. You know what I mean? That's the only way to like really get it, you know, pry open your third eye and all this stuff. Do you feel like that's what's going on here?
I mean, I don't think I know enough about the scene and stuff to like really give an answer to that. You know, I I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, obviously, like, drugs are such a big, you know, part of this, like, dance and rave culture and stuff. And, you know, I think the term, you know, electronic listening music, like, does put it, you know, in that, you know, what you said, like, you know, people afterwards, they're too high, too fucked up to dance anymore. And maybe that's part of, you know, why IDM as a label took off, because it, you know, sort of separates from that. But yeah, I don't think I, like, actually know enough to really say for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I get the sense that, like, that's probably part of it. That, you know, maybe in that sort of early Warp scene, there was a lot of drug use and stuff, but, you know, just in general, I think that the idea of, like, drug music, it implies this sort of, like, close listening thing, like, almost kind of exactly what they were after. And so I just wonder if it wasn't like a, if there's a, just sort of a slightly deliberate attempt here to reach out to those kind of people that, like to, you know, get high and just, like, zone out to their favorite records or whatever. Like, hey, this is, like, the kind of music we're making. Like, this is a perfect record for you. I guess whether you're high or not, they want you to do that similar thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, all this stuff that we're just sort of bringing up, you know, in short here, starts to lead us toward the great IDM debate, which I'm sure we'll return to a few times during this episode. Do you ever feel like this comp is trying to have it both ways? Like, Sean's comments in the album sleeves mini interview, you know, implies that the genre, you know, electronic music is, like, completely stale and this comp is here to shake things up. But then his 2016 comments are like, there was no value judgment. We just wanted to make music for home listening, you know, a different context. The comp itself doesn't really claim to be smarter or anything like that. It just claims to be electronic listening music as opposed to electronic dance music. But everybody decided to call it intelligent dance music anyway. Is that, like, Warp's fault at all? Do you kind of get what I'm after here?
Yeah, I think I understand. Yeah, I, you know, one, first, you know, go into Sean's comments. You know, the first thing is from something from 1992. Second thing that, you know, contradicts it is from 2016.
Right.
You know, obviously, you know, people grow up and stuff. And, you know, I don't think that they were... I actually, like, believe his 2016 statement more, you know, saying there's no value judgment and stuff, because think about what Ottakar was making, you know, before this. You know, Cavity Job and stuff is not something I would call intelligent dance music or anything. You know, it's pretty much just, you know, dance music. So I think it would be pretty shitty to you know, just to be shitting on something that you were making just a few years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's just interesting because the record, like I was saying, it has that kind of punk spirit of, like, hey, this isn't your dad's electronic music or whatever. this isn't, you know, I'm being a little facetious, but, like, this isn't, like, the music you're used to. This is, like, something new. This is something, like, life-changing. And yet it also just kind of has this, like, hey, this is for home. You know, it's you know, you got your music for the club. This is just for a different place. And it's just weird because it has this kind of, it actually did start this kind of firestorm of, like, a totally new approach to electronic music. But it's, like, kind of trying to, I don't know, avoid making a judgment about it. I agree that, like, you know, Sean is, like, a young man and he sounds like a, you know, like early 20-year-old or whatever. When he's making these, like, really bold comments, like, we're going to change the world, all music sucks, you know, and we're going to fix it, you know, which is fine. I get, like, he maybe grew out of that a little bit. But I honestly feel like you got to kind of read both those quotes together. And it's, like, somewhere in the middle. Like,
yeah,
when they were working on this comp, they sometimes felt like, we are going to shake things up in a scene that's really stale. And other times they were just like, you know, I like going to the club too, but this would be fun for a different time, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, the truth lying somewhere in the middle is usually, you know, the correct answer anyways. You know, but yeah, I don't think, like, you know, Warp was trying to say, like, you know, fuck all that old, you know, electronic music. You know, like you said, it's not your dad's electronic music, because, you know, the electronic, you know, like, you know, listening thing, I think it, you know, it's not like it's got to be one or the other. It's just, you know, I think they're just applying a space to it. You know, one's for dancing. And I mean, I think maybe the thing comes up is a lot of, like, that early, you know, 80s, 90s club dance music was very, like, I'm trying to think of a better word, disposable, in the sense that, like, you know, it would just come out on a 12-inch or something. There was a lot of artists that it's just like, one song from them ever, you know, or, you know, or two.
Right, right.
You know, it was a bit disposable, a bit throwaway. And then, you know, to change it and put it at home, you know, focus on the album rather than the single and stuff. I don't think it's saying, you know, that way of doing it is incorrect or wrong or dumb. Our way is smart and stuff. I think they're just sort of bridging that gap between that the club and, you know, stuff like Kraftwerk, which, you know, maybe is a reason, you know, that that's one of the records on here. And almost everybody except Autechre and like one or two other people in those little interviews, one of the questions is like their favorite electronic artists or songs, and almost everybody says some Kraftwerk song, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know, it's just like I just feel really conflicted about it, because it's I don't know, it's bold, but it's also, you know, trying to dodge a question. There's just something mm-hmm. like a little bit, you know, slightly problematic. Maybe that's not the right word, but just like a little weird. And this is just the way of the world, I guess. But it's like, you've got this genre that's probably not taken seriously by a lot of people in sort of the wider, like non-club scene world. And their goal in some ways is a very ambitious one, to like legitimize this genre in front of the world and like reach a bunch of new people. And, you know, reach people who don't go to the club at all and that kind of a thing. And the way they do that is they kind of emulate like classic rock in a weird, like slightly a little bit, you know what I mean? You see this in other cases. I don't want to like offend anybody by like picking a specific example, but let's say like, you know, rap music or something is like, again, in a similar situation where like the wider world is kind of looking down on it as like something like, oh, that's not real music and that's not blah, blah. And then you see certain artists like try to ape classic white people music to sort of legitimize it, you know what I mean? And it's almost like a shame, because it's like,
yeah, like Aerosmith, Run DMC kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. Like, hey, this is how we'll get people to like it. We'll make it more like the thing they already know. And I don't think that's what's going on here, but it's just like, I don't know. It's just like sort of a, there's just like all sorts of problems. And then, you know, a few listener emails can actually start to lead us to a related topic, which I guess we're already kind of verging on. Listener Joe observed, in the middle of the vinyl gatefold, there's a stylized globe with some information that seems to show where the different songs were recorded. And listener Steve brings up B12, saying, in the repress liner notes for Electro Soma by B12, they said that they were heavily influenced by Derek May and Kenny Larkin from the US. At the time of their early 12-inch releases, they said there was an interest in England for imports from Chicago, but apparently not from local producers. So they packaged their records to make them look like imports when they weren't. I found this interesting because I always associate this sound with England because of Warp and Reflex, but apparently that wasn't the perception in the early 90s. You know, I bring this up because the press seemed intent on, you know, erasing techno's U.S. and black roots, and many object to the IDM title because it implies that, you know, the white version of this music is somehow smarter, more sophisticated. You know, do you feel like, this is going to sound judgy, but like Warp and this comp in particular are a little bit complicit in that?
I mean, I don't know if they're complicit in it. I mean, if the back of that record had said, you know, this is intelligent dance music, then I would, yeah. I would definitely say yes, you know. I mean, just because they want to recontextualize it, you know, put it in the living room. And they, I mean, it's a label that is in the UK. I don't think, you know, and also it feels like the, you know, the people at that label and on this comp, you know, are fans of, you know, that stuff. So I don't know. I don't think that they're, I mean, they're definitely not like 100% innocent, but I don't know that it's like with any malice, you know what I mean?
Yeah. They're just like walking a fine line here, because if you do go too far in the direction of like, you know, more like Sean's comments in that interview, I don't think he meant this at all, because I'm sure he was a fan of this like black techno music from the US and everything, but it starts to sound like that shit sucks and we're going to fix it. You know, we're going to do it better. Like if you go, you lean too hard in that direction, you know, it's almost like the record cover itself and Sean's 2016 comments are a little bit more in line on the other side of things, where it's more like, hey, no judgment. This was just for a different setting. You know, that wasn't being served. Nobody was making music for like just chilling out at home, and we wanted to do that. You know, it's almost like impressive how the comp is kind of walking a fine line. But I just thought it was really interesting, like, you know, looking at these kind of this globe that listener Joe talked about, because, you know, a lot of it's coming from England and everything. But there's like Richie Houghton is from I think he's Canadian, but he's from Detroit, he kind of came up in the actual Detroit music scene. You can kind of hear that his track is like much more Detroit techno sounding than anybody else's. And I don't know, it's just interesting. It's like bringing him on seems to kind of like go a little ways toward acknowledging the roots. Like they're not like trying to pretend like they invented this type of music at all. And yet it's like the one white guy making this music over there. You know what I mean? It's just maybe unfortunate.
Yeah. I get that. Yeah. I 100%.
Yeah. I mean, this is some stuff that maybe we'll return to. I just wanted to like kind of bring this stuff up, 'cause I feel like a big part of the reason this record, you know, lives on is because it is kind of controversial. You know, we just think of it as like, oh, this cool thing that happened, but it's like actually quite controversial, and like controversies that live on today. And that just kind of makes it like actually a really important, interesting historical document in a way. But let's start shifting toward the music itself. How would you describe the sound of Artificial Intelligence? And does it live up to the kind of bold promises of that mission statement and the presentation and everything?
As to living up to the promise, I feel like yes, because I enjoy listening to it at home and you know, headphones and stuff. But also, I really wish I like knew more about the the precedent type of electronic stuff, you know, to really, you know, judge the difference. But as far as the sound, it's definitely like got that, you know, techno-y kind of, you know, feel to it and everything. But I mean, there's slower tempos, more sort of ambiance and, just like little accoutrements and stuff in the background, like we're always talking about with Autechre, you know, those little things that you wouldn't notice, I don't think in a club setting, but that you do notice sitting at home, you know, by yourself, headphones, you know, whatever. I think it's a sort of meld of those two things, which I think is the promise of its presentation, maybe.
Yeah, because you know, it's got a lot of like you can hear like a lot of tracks are rooted in techno, but I think it feels very much to me like they're doing something different with the sound palettes and the structures of techno.
Yeah.
There are other tracks though that are like very, much more hip hop oriented. And it's just funny to sort of think like in 1992, I mean, it's not like hip hop was like super new, but it was probably new to a lot of people in 1992. Yeah. Probably new to like, I'm just like talking out my ass completely because I have no idea, but like, I'm willing to bet it was like more underground in the UK than it was in the US, especially by 1992. And so it's just interesting because you think about like techno by 1992 was like not old, but it was like it was like the origins of this sound. Hip hop was like the future of music, you know? Mm-hmm. And just the idea that there's so much of that influence in this, you know, again, it's so hard, and it's something I think we'll repeat a million times, but like it's just so hard to put yourself back in the mind frame of 1992. But I feel like all the hip hop influence here would be like really interesting, you know, like turning techno into hip hop is like a really forward thinking kind of move. And a lot of the artists, not all of them, but a lot of the artists do that here. The other thing I think is so, you know, still impressive to me today is like the focus on songcraft, which is not really what you want in a club setting. You know what I mean? But you think about like the Dice Man's Polygon Window, right? Aphex Twin. It's like quite a like little tightly structured like Fabergé egg of a track. It's got like several, you know, different patterns and loops and stuff like that. But it has such dynamic range, you know what I mean? Where it kind of like it sort of like goes way down, and then you get those like claps, those like echoey claps, like start going. It just like all of a sudden the energy like skyrockets again. You know, it's kind of like jumping between techno and this like very funky kind of bass lick at will and stuff, and like, it's sort of many pieces like assembled into like a very coherent progression of a track. You know what I mean? Like I remember long ago, somebody wrote in and was like, it's so weird how you guys call Autechre pieces songs instead of tracks sometimes. But like some of the tracks here are songs. You know what I'm saying?
I get what you mean. Yeah.
I just think that's like the kind of thing where I start thinking like, okay, yeah, this sounds like the future of electronic music. Like they're actually composing like these little miniature pieces that, you know what I mean? Like how, I don't know, the Beatles, A Day in the Life or something. It's like, It feels like it's a really grand thing, but it's actually not that long. It just like covers like a world of sounds in a very short amount of time. And I just feel like, you know, we're not at A Day in the Life level on any of the songs here, but it's still kind of doing that same thing. There's even tracks like on, IAO's The Clan, you know, which is like the Black Dog basically. That's like a very techno-y kind of track, but it again, like, sort of shifts and like slows down. I mean, it's got just like a nice sort of fast techno beat to it, but then there's like these kind of droney strings and stuff all over it, and they keep kind of like pulling the strings away and then bringing them back, and it's like the tempo doesn't change, but you feel like you're kind of coming mm-hmm. way down and then going way up. And it's like, I'm just so impressed by how it's really stuck in the structure of a techno track, but it's pushing so hard against how far you can push that, you know, stuff you wouldn't do in the club. So, you know, overall, I am impressed. I do think this sounds like future music, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the IAO track is a good example of that, you know, with that techno beat. It's if you, when the strings aren't happening, and if you, you know, could take them away completely, it's pretty up tempo.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the strings just like, they have this like sludge effect, you know, that they like
yeah.
pull it, you know, that they're like shifting the time basically. I think that's a perfect like representation of, you know, what this compilation is trying to accomplish, you know, like I feel like that would be like a great track, you know, after the club, you know, kind of thing. Like you're keeping a little bit of that energy, you know, going or whatever, but you know, you're slowing down, you know, when you walk on the treadmill or whatever, you're supposed to do the cool down at the end.
Yeah.
You know, it's the cool down, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think that's another surprising thing when you put on this record is how much energy is still there. It's mm-hmm. not like just for spacing out.
No, exactly. Yeah.
There's a lot of really catchy, like really high tempo stuff, but it's just like the emphasis is on the little details and the song craft and, you know, the kind of shifts in time, like we've been talking about. And that's, you know, I just assume it sounds impressive to me now. So I'm just like guessing that in 1992, it would blow my fucking mind. You know what I mean? Like, it can't be as impressive now as it was back then, and if I'm still impressed, it must have been super, super impressive.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think what you said earlier about like hip hop, I didn't even think about that. Like 92 is early hip hop, and you're right. I think you're right. You know, also I'm talking to my ass, but you know, UK it was probably even, you know, further behind without the internet and stuff. And yeah, I mean to be like bringing those hip hop elements like that. Yeah, you like. Some people listening to this probably had like never really heard a hip hop song before, you know, or had heard very few. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right to be impressed in 2021. You know, it had to be mind blowing in 92.
Yeah, and I should mention that, like, you know, before we get any, you know, anybody adding us or whatever, we've had some listeners write in, like UK listeners, who talk about like remembering fondly these kind of like sort of hip hop and like electro compilations and stuff that like Sean and Rob shout out specifically. And that, you know, but what the sense I get from these listeners is that this was probably a pretty niche thing. Like this is what the cool, you know, future warp artists were listening to in their mm-hmm. garages and stuff, you know? And so I think a lot of new listeners would be hearing it for the first time. And, you know, not to belabor the point, but you know, hip hop is a kind of slower genre. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, techno or something, yeah. which is just like kind of blitzing you with energy, because especially in the early 90s, you're kind of supposed to like feel this beat and then you're supposed to like listen to the words, you know, like uh-huh. that's, you know, that's kind of like the cool, like play with time that I think a lot of these tracks are doing, which is like, yeah, you can feel it in your body still, but like you can also zone in on it. Now, I love this comment from listener Joe, who writes, I know that you've already gone down the rabbit hole of whether AE's albums are comments on current events and correctly concluded that it's a bunch of nonsense, but I do think that we're all product of our time and so is the art we make. As a whole, the AI series sounds generally like something truly from the early 90s when the US and Russia were friends and no longer had their fingers on the triggers of ICBMs. Global warming was still something most people were only vaguely aware of at best. Far-right parties were an unfunny joke of the past, and technology seemed to provide endless hope for an optimistic Star Trek The Next Generation-esque future. The music sounds so happy, positive, and seems to present technology as something to be embraced and celebrated rather than feared and skeptical of. What do you think about that? Do you hear that kind of optimism and that the like kind of pro-technology theme in the music?
You know, I really like that that comment from Joe. You know, again, like we've talked about with, you know, current events and Ottegger kind of stuff, I think it's maybe a bit of hindsight, you know, because I do hear, you know, it does seem like sort of happy and stuff, but also I think a lot of like looking back at the 90s, you know, it's not like there was no problems in the 90s. It was all, you know, milk and honey kind of thing. It's just like when you look back, you know, you see how good we had it back then, you know.
And also
I think it's sort of like easy to associate that with, you know, if you got a record like this, that it is fairly upbeat, and you know, it's not scary or sad sounding or anything. So I think it's easy to like associate those kind of things. But I do, I mean, what Joe said, you know, we're all the product of our time. And so it's the art we make. Like, you know, I really like that and agree with it. So, you know, I think it definitely like leaks in there, but I don't know if it was their, you know, intention, because I don't think anyone at the time was like, oh man, you know, the 90s are going to be the best. You know,
but they might have been, you know, because like I think about this often, where it's like when I was young. Okay, our younger listeners may not know this, but when I was young, like social media was an objectively fun and exciting thing. Like there was no, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? There was like no downside. We were all like,
well, because
wow,
your parents weren't.
This
on
is
it
great,
yet, you know.
Yeah, our parents weren't on exactly. it, and it was just like, but it had this kind of like, wow, dude, like you can reach out to whoever. There aren't going to be any gatekeepers in society anymore. Like this is going to change the world. It's going to fix everything. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
the music industry is dead. The movie industry is dead. Like, you know, propaganda won't exist. You know, we were like, I swear to God, we felt that way.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, and now like, it's like literally the exact opposite in every way imaginable. But the point is I can totally imagine like an early 90s where like technology was just, you know, the kind of like computer technology and computer music and stuff like that was just seen as like something to be excited about. And I feel like this album does kind of have that. It has like, you know, maybe not like a happiness all the time, but like a energy that's just like invigorated. Like this is cool. It almost has this like, again, this is a hindsight thing, but it has this like, it's almost like the 90s are going to rock, dude. Like they really are. Like this is going to be a fun decade or something like that. And I also have this like sort of half serious theory. I really honestly agree with Joe a lot that like the 90s was kind of like this weird golden age, because like the Cold War ended, but 9/11 didn't happen yet. And it was just like,
oh, yeah, for 100%. Yeah.
I know there were problems, but it was just like a decade of like, you know, less problems, honestly, than I think they maybe even appreciated at the time. But anyway, so I do hear that optimism. Now, we are an Autechre podcast, so before we start getting into favorite tracks, let's talk about Autechre's contribution specifically. First, let me just lay out everything our listeners had to say about Crystal, the first one here. Listener Espen called it the standout tune from this release. Listener Steve wrote, Crystal is one of my favorite AE tracks. It has a complex layered percussion with a beautiful melodic bass line and then another melody layered on top. This is different from modern Autechre, but it's what made me fall in love with them originally. Listener Joe wrote, Crystal is like Autechre noisily pulling up to the spaceship and their shuttle pod and taking over the DJ rig, deciding it's time to really start the party. It's one of their great early banger tracks and sounds like the logical continuation of the kind of music they'd been doing on Lego Feet, Cavity Job, Warp Tapes. However, the slowdown section at the end is like them saying, okay, this whole early career party has been fun, but it's time for a new era. The song is like a literal transition between their early era and the next era. Indeed, a lot of our listeners highlighted this slowdown part, like listener Ella, who wrote, Crystal is a banger with a slowdown at the end that foreshadows their later experimentation with time. So what do you think about Crystal?
It's a great track, but I think, you know, as many of the listeners pointed out, you know, that messing with time, like, really is one, I think, fits this series so well. You know, that's something you wouldn't do in the club, I don't think.
Right.
You don't want to fuck up the dancing, you know, kind of, you know, and mm-hmm. doing that would. And yeah, I think, you know, what Joe said, you know, it's sort of like a great transition between the early era and the next era kind of thing. Because, yeah, Autechre, like, consistently does that, you know, from the rest of their, you know, Amber on and everything, you know, that's a big thing of them switching up time, slowing down, you yeah. know, kind of thing. You know, that's definitely the highlight of this song. I like the track and stuff, but that's really what I think takes it from, you know, a good, you know, early IDM kind of track and sort of like shows Autechre's you know, future promise. Again, maybe it's just like the 90s and we're you know, looking at it with hindsight, but I think it really, you know, I tried to think, like, if I was listening to this in 1992, like which of these artists, like, would I want to check out a record from? And I really do think that, like, Crystal, and specifically the way that time shift happens, would make me want to check out Autechre.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, except for I would go even farther and say that, like, that kind of inventiveness is running through the whole track because you have a pretty, like, clattery beat, you know? It's got, like, this gunfire kind of a, like, snare roll thing going on. The hi-hats are, like, really hard. You've got, like, all these clipped and chopped sounds, like, very aggressive kind of hip-hop energy. And we hear that, you know, beat on the Warp Tapes, right? But what's new about this is that it's got the kind of, like, these, like, spacious sort of droney low notes that form this kind of chord progression over the thing. And you get these kind of, like, lasery, twisted, bendy, like, high synths and stuff running over the thing. And so it does that kind of thing we were talking about earlier, where it's, like, the beat is really fast, but all of the, like, melody is sort of slowing it down, you know? And then it just sort of delivers. It's not just like a random, like, hey, slow down any track. It would work the same way. It works, I think, because the track has been sort of warping, no pun intended, your sense of time. And then it slows down and you get those, like, bendy melodies, like, sort of reformed for the slower part at the end. And they're just, like, so great. I mean, honestly, it's, like, a super impressive track and just feels like a perfect execution of the electronic listening music idea, right? Because it's, like, really, I don't know, bend it. You can feel the beat, but then, like, your brain gets, like, taken away by these, like, weird droney, spacious, slowed down melodies over the top, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's for sure a highlight of this record, like, and not even just because we're an Autechre podcast, you know?
Yeah.
I want to stress that almost, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really great. Now, there's maybe less consensus on The Egg, the second AE track here. Listener Espen writes, The Egg is basically a mix of Eggshell from Incunabula, and I think Eggshell is the better one. However, it's a nice track for sure. Listener Ella called it a beautiful look at what would later become Eggshell. Listener Tyler says, I don't really care for The Egg at all. I'd probably skip it when revisiting this compilation if Autechre hadn't become as big as they did later on. Eggshell is much better executed. Listener Steve said he actually prefers The Egg, adding, it has a lot of the percussion that you hear in the Warp Tapes, and they seem to have taken a lot of that out in the album version. It also has the record scratching they later used on Envain. Similarly, listener Joe asks, do you think they consider this an early version that they were able to create as well as possible with the equipment they had, and after they signed to Warp, were given an actual budget, they were able to access better synths and make the version they really wanted to. It's interesting how they named the final version Eggshell. Obviously, it's a play on words, but it's a much more stripped down and minimalist version of The Egg, which is more of a traditional pre-AI banger. Do you think Eggshell is a comment on this? How much of the sound from the earlier version was stripped away? So what do you think about that, and what do you think about The Egg in general?
Well, you know, at first I like The Egg. It's definitely not as good as Crystal, I think. And I agree with the first couple listeners. I think Eggshell is sort of the better version of it. But I like what Joe brought up, you know. I didn't think of it that way, but yeah, perhaps it is, rather than a remix of it, maybe it is just a, you know, almost a re-recording, just now that they had access to better stuff and everything. I don't really know, but definitely, I mean, I think the name has to be, you know, some sort of comment on it. You know, it's at least a reference. You know, I was trying to think, you know, eggshell, you know, it's like, you know, surrounds the egg, you know, so I don't know. Yeah. I was hoping something would come out, but it's not working.
Yeah, I don't know about I mean, I really like that comment that it's like that Eggshell might be actually a comment on the original track. And, you know, I agree that Eggshell kind of improves upon this, like, immeasurably. It strips things away, but in doing so, it makes it much grander. Mm-hmm. Like, we talked a lot about how Eggshell feels like this just monolithic kind of tower of a track. It just, like, goes, and it just feels huge. And from the listeners that we just read a second ago, like, I'm kind of in listener Tyler's camp. Like, I think this is kind of a bad track, The Egg. It's a mess. It like, Eggshell just, again, strips away all the clutter.
Yeah.
And it just turns it like amps up the big walls of synth and actually does a better job in, like, giving us, like, this great groove, but, like, just slowing it almost to a standstill with these huge walls of sound. And, you know, you just feel like you're floating when you're listening to that. The Egg is just like, it's like these kind of wild, like, clattery drums, kind of similar to Crystal, but they kind of win out over everything else. And the thing that really bothers me is that it has like no structure. This is like when I kind of hate electronic music, when this kind of track happens, where it's like there is a loop, there's a beat, and they're just like doing different like solos or something mm-hmm. over it. You know, there's like a part where this kind of weird dentist drill sound starts happening. Then it gets turned into like a little kind of rhythmic pattern. You get like a few bars of like this little wah-wah melody thing going on. You know, you get a few bars of like DJ scratches all of a sudden. And like none of these things ever return. It's like literally they just have like the bed, which is the beat, and it's like a wildly clattery beat, and they're just doing random shit over it for like a couple bars, move on to the next random shit. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like they just identified what really works about this track and kept only that, but this is a mess.
Yeah, I can see that. And what you said about like the little solo thing, I think that's, you know, people who don't love electronic music and stuff, you know, that knob twiddling, you know, moniker comes up a lot. Like, yeah, like you're just kind of fucking around. And I think that, you know, just bringing in something and taking it away and that has that sort of knob twiddly kind of feel.
Yeah.
You know, it makes the egg sort of feel like, you know, oh, we like this beat, you know, we're sort of, you know, jamming on it to find, you know, what goes well with it, over it, you know, kind of thing. And then I think they had the good sense of, you know, when making Eggshell, instead of, you know, adding to it, you know, taking away,
yeah,
you know, it's the old less is more kind of thing.
Yeah, it's just the opposite of what I was talking about earlier, like with the Polygon Window track, which is like this perfectly orchestrated, like it has like, let's say, eight different parts or something, eight different loops and things. Mm-hmm. And they're just kind of like, it's just perfectly executed the way, like, sometimes they're all playing, sometimes just like two are playing, but they kind of like build and the whole track like rises and then the whole track falls and it builds again. And it's just like when that like sick bass lick comes in, it's like, you know, just so much fun. And then when it drops out, it's like exciting, like what's going to happen next. It just is all tied together in this perfect composition. The egg is like not a composition. It's just a loop with like jamming over the top. And I just feel like it just doesn't work for me. Now, I should mention that listener Wendell called both tracks good but forgettable for him. You know, you sort of talked about Crystal, but do you see them as like highlights of this collection, even if you weren't an Autechre stan?
Yeah, I think I pretty much already said it. But yeah, I definitely do with Crystal. You know, I think it's a well composed piece that time shifting is interesting and forward looking. The egg, you know, definitely not as much, you know, it's almost like I almost honestly would have rather, instead of putting the egg on here, you know, either getting another artist, you know, to have a song,
yeah,
or
yeah,
something, you know,
because like what you were talking about earlier, it's like, if I was listening to this in 1992 and I was like, well, who would I want to hear a record from? Like you were saying, like Crystal would be like, holy shit, I got to get their record. And then the egg would be like,
yeah, maybe not.
Maybe
they got lucky.
Essential,
you know? Yeah, maybe they got lucky, yeah, on that, yeah, one. Yeah, definitely. You know, I don't think the egg is, you know, like people wouldn't talk about the egg if Autechre didn't become, you know, what they are today. But I think,
and if they didn't remake it, like,
no,
things,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly,
and it's almost
exactly
unfair because it's like it's never gonna beat Eggshell, I don't think. So it just like sort of, you could never listen to it without thinking about that much superior version. But it's maybe fortunate, because if Eggshell was on this compilation, mm-hmm, it would blow everything else out of the fucking water, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Well, other than Autechre, what are your favorite tracks here and why? First, though, as always, I want to quiz you. The problem is that, like, on Rate Your Music, the individual track ratings are pretty close to each other, but there are two with a 3.9 making them the highest. Nothing bolded. But what do you think? Can you get one of those two?
I think I would pick Polygon Window and probably Crystal, just because those are the two most famous people.
Well, so really surprisingly, neither of those is the 3.9 rated. The one of them is The Egg by Autechre.
Oh. Like
we've just been shitting on it.
Weird.
And then the other one is Speedy J's Deorbit. Those are the two highest rated. But again, they are all like quite close. There's sort of a couple notable lower ones, which I'll quiz you on later. But what are your favorite tracks here, non-Autechre favorite tracks?
Yeah, I really like Fill 3 by Speedy J.
Oh,
you know, I in reading, I see a lot of people, you know, kind of prefer Deorbit, but I like this one. It's just like this I think encapsulates the cover of this record quite a bit. You know, it's such like a spacey song, you know, there's just like, you know, these sort of pads going on, whatever. And then there's like these weird beeps that, I don't know, it sounds like, you know, something in a space station, like a comm system or something, you know, just sort of gently beeping in the background, kind of thing. So I like that song, a lot.
Yeah. And I love how like all those kind of beeps, they like, it's like got like kind of a nice like complexity of composition because they all kind of like interlock, you know what I mean, into like these kind of, you know, almost Baroque like sort of melodies. It is really a gorgeous track, and it's one of the ones where it's like, you know, a lot of people shout out like Brian Eno and stuff for sort of starting the long, you know, invention to lead us to artificial intelligence type, you know, IDM type music, you know what I mean. And like this is the one track where you can hear like that influence like really heavily, but I do think it's like a really gorgeous track. What else?
You know, obviously, I mean, the Dice Man, Polygon Window, Aphex Twin, whatever you want to call him, you know, I mean, that's an obvious, you know, good track right there. I talked about it a little bit, but I like IAO from the Clan. You said that's Black Dog in real life.
Well,
right?
it's the opposite. IAO is the Black Dog, and the song is called the Clan.
Oh, see, it's so annoying.
It's really confusing.
It's so confusing.
See, I kind of wonder, like, what do you think of? I don't. Again, I'm talking completely out of my ass, but like, there are so many freaking like aliases, you know, in early electronic music, and I guess it sort of continues on throughout the '90s. But like, is that because of club culture? Like, if the Black Dog got too popular, no DJs would want to spin their records because, like, oh, everybody knows the Black Dog. But if it's always like a new name, you know, then it seems kind of fresh and cool or something, you know?
It just seems like, I mean, maybe it's because I'm thinking of it in the, you know, 2020 context, but it seems so like counterintuitive because, like, wouldn't you want people to? Oh, I like Black Dog, you know. Oh, I'll check out this song on this compilation. Like, you know, I do like the Black Dog, and I didn't know that's who that was, you know, until reading about this and stuff. And you know, Aphex Twin, that used to piss me off so much, you know, back in the iPod days, having to have, you know, 18 different goddamn artists, you know, listed for the same person, you know, kind of thing. I have no idea.
I've always wondered, and like if any listeners like know, like write us gonkastpod@gmail.com. like what is up with the huge amount of aliases in like early electronic music, especially?
No other genre that I could think of
it's so weird.
It's so weird.
But you know, I like the Dice Man track a lot. You know, that's actually such an amazing thing because Polygon Window is an alias.
So annoying Aphex too. Yeah.
And now this has its own alias, the Dice Man. love that. But yeah, that's a great track. I mean, just such a great intro. Like, I think I talked about it enough, but just the interlocking parts to me are just like dazzling on that track. The Clan by IAO is also like one of my absolute favorites on this record. I think I talked about it enough as well, but just like the way it's sort of pushing against the structures of techno music, and it's just like such an interesting sound palette. And like by the end, when you get like the strings and the sort of stomping like beat going at the same time, it's just like the most like, I don't know, gorgeous, like epic thing to me. You know, I love Deorbit by Speedy J a lot. I think it's got like a very, I don't know, almost like futuristic, I don't know, future looking kind of thing, because it's like just a very clean, almost trip hop style. And I know that like trip hop was starting to be a thing, you know, I think Massive Attack's Blue Lines came out in 1991. But if you just played me this track, I would guess it was from like 96 or 97 or something. I just think it's got like this cool, kind of cool, like grainy breakbeat to it. And again, like a real, like the sort of like chopped, like bendy choir thing is just absolutely mind-boggling, and it just becomes like this very grand, like all the strings and stuff on it, it's just like mesmerizing, this track. You know, let me give you a quick rundown though on our listeners' favorite tracks. Listener Espen highlighted the contributions from The Dice Man and Dr. Alex Patterson. Listener Ella shouted out Polygon Window, Telephone 529, The Clan, and Deorbit. And listener Steve also called Deorbit one of his favorites, adding Speedy J is masterful and this track is timeless. Listener Steve also shared his thoughts on the rest of the tracks here, and it's clear that he really likes almost all of them. He goes so far as to call this comp one of my favorite albums of all time. So, not a lot of consensus here, but anything to say about any of the other tracks that were mentioned here?
Not specifically, but I think the not a ton of consensus, it's kind of a good thing. I think it shows that you know, most everything here is good and worth listening to, except maybe a little bit, which leads us to our next section.
Yeah. I wanted to add, I think that like it almost kind of works for this record that like nothing is too classic. Like none of the tracks in themselves are like too,
yeah, you know, you don't want to waste like you don't want to waste eggshell on a comp, you know,
but you also don't want to like send this thing out of balance. Like you need everything to be on the same level, so it's like this kind of nice satisfying, you know, journey all the way through. And so it's kind of, you know, it's not like even in 1992 this was not Richard D. James's best track that he had done up to that point, you know, but it's like a good one because it doesn't like too outshine everything else. It kind of like actually serves everything else. But yeah, let's get into what you were talking about earlier, tracks we don't like. There are two tracks which are rated you know, definitely lower than any of the others. Can you guess one?
Well, I'll just say mine. Spiritual High.
That is one of them. Yeah.
Okay.
And the other one is Premonition by Musicology.
Okay. But, that would be my second one.
Okay. So why not? Why do you dislike these?
Spiritual High is awful. I don't know why it's on here. It's just like a, it's like a rave up track. The whole time the goddamn cymbal. Just over and over and over and over. It's just like, I mean, maybe if I was in the club, I wouldn't be so annoyed with it. But like, you know, in this
context,
it's in this context of sitting at home, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. It's got this weird, like, you know, Jersey Shore fist pumping, you know, kind of feel to it. You know, while I'm trying to sit on the couch, in my notes, my first thing I wrote was this song fucking sucks.
I mean, I don't like hate it. I mean, it's like pretty standard, like Detroit techno. We were talking earlier about how this is like Richie Hawtin's contribution, and he comes from this world, which in some ways Warp was trying to pull away from, you know? So it's like weird to have him on this, even though with like Plastic Man, he gets like pretty crazy and experimental in all these same ways. So it's not like outside of his wheelhouse or anything, but this particular contribution is like really kind of the thing that this, you know, that this compilation is almost like denouncing, or, you know, again, all the problematic nature of that. Are they denouncing it? Are they not? And on that note, it makes me think like, okay, is the inclusion of this track trying to say, hey, even this stuff that you think is just disposable club only music is worth listening to closely. You know, we want to put it on here because we want you to try listening to it in a different context. Try putting on at home. Maybe you've never put a track like this on at home before, and you'll hear some really cool things. Like, actually listen to this shit because it's worth it. You know, in that sense, it would kind of lean me more toward the side we were talking about earlier of like, they're not trying to diss, you know, dance music at all. You know what I mean? They're just trying to like make you listen in a different context, you know? On the other hand, it also being here helps me think of how different the other tracks are. But either way, it's just such a weird, and it's the longest track here, you know? So it's like, or almost, yeah, it actually is. Yeah, it's just a couple seconds longer than The Egg. But it's just, I don't hate it because I don't hate this kind of music. And actually, there's like a kind of part at the end where like you actually get like kind of a nice droney synth pad over the thing, and it like kind of slows things down a little bit in the way I was talking about. But it just doesn't really work on this comp for me.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying about, you know, it should you listen to that music at home too? Like, does it deserve a place outside of the club? That could be, you know, the reason they put it on here, and I like that. I didn't think about it, but if that's the case, I have a problem with the sequencing of it. You know, we're in the middle, you know, toward, you know, the back half of the record here. At this point, you know, I've been chilling out for six songs, it's a bad spot for it. You know, like if it was up top, and then, you know, we're gradually getting, you know, calmer. And, you know, if this is the, like, you know, you came from the club, now you're at home. You know, I could see it a little more, but at track seven, it just sort of like comes out of nowhere, and like, I don't know. I look at that cover, and that robot, he looks like he's not sleeping, but he's drifting off a little bit. Almost, you know that kind of thing. Yeah. this would be And I've talked about it on the podcast before. Like, I always go to bed listening to music, and I hate when you forget when you forget there's that one song that's like real loud or real, you know, this is that song. This is the one that if I fell asleep to this record would wake me up, and I guess it would be my fault, but it would make me mad.
So I guess I just feel kind of like it's a fine track, like not spectacular, but it just does not fit here for me. The musicology track Premonition, on the other hand, I actively dislike. I think this is like
it's
not
awesome.
A good song.
Yeah.
It's like got this weird kind of like Latin dance thing with like these kind of like piano, you know, like sort of samba like type chord stab things.
Yeah.
And a horrible, you know, I was complaining about this last time about like just certain early electronic music tropes that I don't like personally. And like this kind of vocal sample of like this boisterous singing that runs through the entire track. I hate it. It what pisses me off honestly about it is that you get this kind of weird, like almost dissonant string loop a couple times, and it feels like they submitted this track and it was like it's not quite like artificial intelligence enough, and they were like, what if I put like a kind of weird synth thing that doesn't fit like some bars, and they were like, yeah, I guess I would make it more experimental, more weird. And it just feels so lazy and like doesn't fit. And I'm like, why? Like, it's almost like they just made a dance track and they tried to make it a little bit like more experimental, and they just kind of made like a bad dance track. It didn't succeed. You know what I mean? It's like too far still in the dance area. I hate this track, and I can't believe it's B12, because I also really, really love Telephone 529 by Musicology, which came earlier in the record.
Yeah. I basically agree with everything you said, especially that it's weird that it's the same artist, because I don't mind that. Yeah. I don't mind that first song. I actively like it, but Premonition, it sucks. Like that sample, I always bitch about vocal samples, but it is just that like such stereotypical, you know what it reminds me of? Like, you know, I think we got younger listeners, but remember like in the late 90s, you know, early 2000s, like late at night when you're watching like Comedy Central or something, there's always those commercials for like CD compilations, and it would always be like, dance tracks or whatever, and it would be like those ones you hear at like shitty weddings and stuff. And this sounds like one of those kind of, like, this fits on that more than it fits here. You know, just scratch off that little dissonant synth they added, and pop it on. Now that's what I call, you know, dance music or whatever.
Yeah, I know.
It's awful.
I really don't like it.
And those chords, that da 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 da, it's so lame.
I know. And, you know, and I know like B12 a little bit, like not all their work, but some of their work. And I've never heard a B12 track that sounds like this. I don't know what the fuck this is. Like, it just seems to come out of nowhere, because I really like B12. I'll just say, like, in general, for me, the first half of this record, the first five tracks, each track is literally, in my opinion, better than the last. Like, it just is incredible for the first five songs. And there's like a huge stumble with track 6 and 7 and 8. I told you I don't like The Egg that much. And like, I like that Speedy J track. I think the Dr. Alex Patterson track is like, it's okay. It's just kind of like a cool off, like the record's ending kind of a thing.
It's a good outro.
Yeah. But it just feels like the first half of this record is like awesome, and then it kind of is like a mess for the entire second half.
I completely agree. I think if you put, you know, Phil 3 above Musicology, you know, Premonition, you could just turn the record off there, and you'd be fine. You'd probably be better off, honestly. You know, I don't hate that Alex Patterson track or Peterson, but it is just sort of like it works well as the last track in this context. But I wouldn't be missing anything if I got out of listening to Musicology, you know, Premonition, and had to give that one up. I would gladly do so.
Well, as far as our listeners go, listener Ella wrote, if I had to choose a least favorite, it would be Spiritual High. It doesn't really go anywhere and kind of overstays its welcome as the longest track, but even then, I don't outright dislike it. And listener Steve said he always thought Polygon Window was the weakest track on the compilation. Listener Wendell is a bit more comprehensive with his criticisms, writing, I usually like the Black Dog's extended family of early stuff, but the Belial and IAO tracks on the two comps aren't as good as what's on Bites. Speedy J hasn't yet moved into that harder sound that appealed to me at that time in my life. The first one's A. Tracks are good but forgettable for me, and there are better versions of the Orb track on the actual Orb albums. That's the Dr. Alex Patterson thing. I also want to note that listener Steve acknowledged that the Alex Patterson track may sound cliche by today's standards because of all it has all of the hallmarks of ambient techno from this period, Oz, water and wave field recordings and trancey repetition, but he defended it saying it's really well executed here and it's a fitting closer to this album. I think part of why this may sound cliche is because the orb helps cement what this music sounded like in many people's minds. So this starts to lead us to a big question we've got to address. How well has this record age? Listener Espen wrote, "Not every tune has aged that great, but they at least have a nostalgic place in my musical universe." On the other hand, listener Wendell wrote, "I gotta say the AI comps didn't do it for me taste-wise. I can recognize their importance and interest as historical pieces, but since I came to them after being into Aphex Twin, I Care Because You Do, Autechre, Tri-Repete, and the Black Dog Spanners, they didn't have that impact they might have if I'd heard them earlier." So, you know, the big question, how do you think these tracks have held up? Did they get immediately outpaced by the music of the next few years?
A little bit, yeah. You know, I sort of agree with this listener. You know, I get the importance of the compilation, you know, from a historical, you know, document. And I like that, you know. I mean, obviously, I do a podcast about music. I enjoy the, you know, the history and learning those sorts of things. But if I was just, you know, somebody who came up to me, you know, wanted to get into electronic dance music or, you know, IDM or, you know, whatever you want to call it kind of thing, I don't think I would say, you know, listen to this first, because there are some things here that do sound fairly dated. I mean, even in the good tracks, you know, some of the machines used and stuff, like, you know, you can tell their age a little bit. And then, I mean, really things like Premonition, I mean, not to keep harping on it, but it sounds dated as hell, and it, you know, really brings this down. Same with Spiritual High. So I definitely agree with the listener. I think it's more for, you know, if you're interested in history and stuff, there's definitely good songs here. Definitely ones that have held up, you know, Autechre, Aphex, you know, things like that. But there's also ones that have not, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like it doesn't really sound that dated to me. It sounds like maybe a little bit simpler and more primitive, like, and it is kind of like wild, like, honestly mind-blowing how fast things moved at this time.
Exactly.
You know, because like by the following year, I think pretty much like all of these artists had made something like much better than what's on this comp, you know, and like a bunch of other artists, you know, have obviously made classics of their own and stuff. And it's just like, you know, it must have been mind-blowing when it first came out, and I think in a lot of respects it still is, but it was just like so quickly outpaced. And, you know, a lot of these artists, like, you know, they just went wild. I think the problem is not the datedness for me. It's more of like just the hodgepodge nature that you're talking about. It almost seems like they didn't have a clear idea of what, you know, this IDM thing was going to be. And they kind of threw a bunch of things at the wall. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we talked about how the egg is not totally successful, but like, you know, Spiritual High is like kind of a weird, like, it just doesn't fit what we think of is what this should be. And it just feels like, because about half the album is, I think, like really, really solid and the other half is not, it's more of just like a, let's try a bunch of things. And then electronic music kind of went in a direction that made a bunch of these like irrelevant. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Actually, I think that's sort of maybe the better way to look at those things. Cause yeah, I think I'm looking at it, you know, with hindsight again. You know, I know where a lot of these artists end up and, you know, just how the genre as a whole does. So yeah, I think that's maybe a fairer way to think about it.
Well, listener Wendell also brought up an issue that listener Joe asks about more directly. Joe writes, "It's worth noting that both of the first two tracks, as well as Deorbit and The Egg to an extent, were featured on albums later in the AI series. Do you think that Warp originally intended the comp to be a sampler of material that would come later in the series, or that it just so happened that these songs would be on both the comp and the later albums too?" I mean, what do you think about that? And what do you think about the fact that we got better versions and even context for a lot of these tracks almost immediately, you know, like he mentions like the first two tracks and stuff, but like IAO's The Clan is on Bites, Deorbit is on Speedy J's Ginger, you know, like The Egg gets a better version immediately. Wendell mentioned that the Dr. Alex Patterson track, I think it's kind of like a remix technically of an Orb track that I'm honestly not familiar with, but like you have the Orb version, which he likes more. So that's kind of a tough hill for this compilation to get over, you know what I mean, that like all these records got sort of better versions and proper album placement almost immediately.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely doesn't help with the longevity. But I guess, yeah, I mean, if it was intended to be a sampler, you know, a label sort of sampler, that's not such a bad way to do it. And then, you know, it's not the label or this compilation's fault that, like, it became this historical document. Again, I think it's like looking at it with hindsight, you know, they probably, you know, most of these label sampler kind of things, it's nobody's going to think about them in a couple years. You know, they're sort of like, you know, disposable, you know, just a way to, I mean, you got to think in the 90s to listen to something that would never get played on the radio, like all of these bands, you know, you had to put down $20 or whatever to buy the CD. So, you know, these sampler things were sort of, you know, you could say, oh, you know, I'm liking this Autechre thing. But then also, you know, why all the different names and everything, you know, that sort of throws a wrench in the works there.
I mean, if it was a sampler, it would serve that purpose nicely, I think, and probably actually did get a lot of people into these artists. But it just sort of, I think it hurts the album sort of that there are better places to listen to all of the highlights from this, honestly. Now, this starts to lead us toward the second comp, but first I just wanted to note that listener Joe and several others as well claimed that, quote, the sequencing is fantastic and gives it the feel of a true album. You know, do you agree? We talked about, like, the first half being much stronger than the second half, but does it feel like a proper record experience?
I think the first half does, and then it's just the placement of, you know, those two, the, you know, Premonition and Spiritual High, they just really derail the thing. And even, I mean, even to an extent, the Egg, I don't think is expertly placed or anything. I mean, half of it is sequenced great and the other half awful. So, you know, I think it sort of just evens out in the wash.
I
mean, there,
I appreciate the sequencing, honestly. And I feel like, you know, if you, maybe not everybody did, but if you got it on vinyl, right, like, that first half would be like a stunner, and Deorbit is kind of a nice grand closing track. And then it would just sort of kick off with Premonition if you happen to be into like that. So it's like not so disruptive in that case. And then we talked about, you know, Speedy J's Fill 3 and then Dr. Alex Patterson's track kind of leading us, sort of chilling us out into like a nice conclusion to the whole record, not even just that side. So I appreciate the effort that went into it. I think it does stumble where you said, but I do think it's like quite nicely sequenced.
It's better sequenced than like the few other you know, label samplers I've listened to in my limited experience.
All right, well, we ready to move on to Artificial Intelligence 2?
Yeah, let's do it. As we mentioned before, Artificial Intelligence was the first record in a series, and Warp released 7 more AI installments between 1992 and 1994. These included Surfing on Sine Waves by Polygon Window, aka Richard D. James, Bites by Black Dog Productions, Electrosoma by B12, Dimension Intrusion by Fuse, Ginger by Speedy J, Incunabula by Autechre, and last but not least, Artificial Intelligence 2, which came out May 30th, 1994. Warp had basically succeeded in sparking an electronic music revolution, so this time the sleeve notes provided a straightforward overview of electronic music's history instead of making any bold proclamations about its future. The comp also has proven less memorable than its predecessor. Pitchfork sums it up pretty well, saying the second volume doesn't hold up nearly as well. Oddly, while it has more variety, it also seems more generic. By 1994, there were a lot of people making electronic listening music, and this doesn't feel like a particularly special assemblage of what was out there. It's a bit surprising, then, that the Artificial Intelligence 2 is rated slightly higher on Rate Your Music at 3.61.
Yeah, and let me just give you another rundown on this comp's notable pseudonyms. Link is Global Communication, Richard H. Kirk is from Cabaret Voltaire, and Belial is the Black Dog again. We'll talk about all the others too, but let me just mention the Artificial Intelligence 2 has 4 bonus tracks on a limited edition version. This is what's currently available on streaming, but we're just going to ignore those bonus tracks and focus on the original 10. Before we get started, let me ask you again, Dan, what is your sense of this comp's reputation?
You know, this one less so than Artificial Intelligence 1. You know, I feel like I really never hear about this one. Outside of doing this podcast, I don't think I really knew much about it, honestly.
Yeah, it's a little bit forgotten, I think. And, you know, we were sort of getting at it at the end of the last section there, but like, it was just like the need for comps like this, it was like almost, you know, unnecessary by 1994. You know what I mean? We had like almost classic albums from a lot of these artists and stuff. So maybe it's cool to hear more stuff, but it just like, I don't know, easy to overlook, easy to forget, I think. What is your personal history with this installment?
I don't think I really, you know, I knew of it because I, you know, I knew about the artificial intelligence series, but I know more of those records and the first comp and stuff. And yeah, this one just sort of overlooked. I don't think I really listened to it until we went over it here on the podcast.
Yeah, I think I'm probably about the same. I mean, I definitely like checked it out, I think, when I first got into the first artificial intelligence compilation, but didn't really return to it or feel like the need to until we were doing this episode. So we started with the context of the first comp, and I think it makes sense to start with the very different context of AI2, as we already have sort of started doing. You read that comment from Pitchfork about this kind of electronic listening music sounding ordinary by 1994, and listener Joe raises the same point in listing just some of the classic electronic albums that came out between AI1 and AI2, which weren't part of the series. UF Orb, Moby's debut, both volumes of Saw, Orbital 2, Tango Invective, Sabersonic debut by Bjork, Quick, I never know how to pronounce that, by Cifil, Experience by The Prodigy, Dub No Bass with My Head Man, and Lifeforms, among others I'm sure I'm forgetting. Joe argues that AI2 always had unfair expectations put upon it and does a fine job of being a normal comp, promoting the artist, the label, etc. But he also writes, the thing that strikes me most about AI2 is how much more developed the sounds are just 2 years later. So let me ask you right off the bat, when you listen to the second comp, do you feel like this is something that had already been made redundant by the electronic classics around it? Or is it kind of a genuinely impressive like representation of how much electronic music had grown in 2 years, like a impressive update from AI1?
I think it can be both. You know, if you look at this as a, you know, little snapshot of just 2 years later, and I think maybe that, you know, To Pitchfork's point and stuff, a lot of people listening to this maybe don't realize that it's just 2 years later. You know, then it is an impressive and sort of interesting, you know, document like the first thing. In that you see how much progress was made in just such a short amount of time. But it's also like this one feels more like those, you know, sort of generic throwaway label samples, like in the sense that it's just, you know, showing you, you know, showing off who's on the label and you know, sort of promoting those artists, whereas the first comp was, you know, promoting like an idea, but you know, the idea at this point is so well known and abundant that it kind of doesn't need promoting anymore, you know.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it, that it's sort of promoting an approach to music making, and this one is just like promoting some music. I do agree with Joe that it's like, you put it on, and especially if you're going like back to back, which I guess, you know, maybe some people do that, but like in the 90s, you wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But if you were like, when you're going straight from AI1 to AI2, it is kind of impressive like how updated the sound is. You know, it just sounds like things are like cleaner, things are more high def, like things are, you know, it just feels like, I don't know, like digital technology had also advanced at the same time, you know what I mean? It's just like immediately impressive in that way. But when you think about the presentation or the lack thereof, you know, we don't get any like kind of striking image of like, you know, a robot saying like, hey, you should listen to this music like you've never listened to electronic music before. We get some like weird flowers or whatever.
It's a pitcher plant.
A what?
A pitcher plant. They eat bugs.
Oh, okay. And there's like a little bug on it too.
Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Wonder what that means. But you know, you don't get like that comment on that, like meta comment on electronic music like you do with the first cover art. You don't get, you know, like you said, any of these like bold proclamations about like what electronic music ought to be or anything like that. So do you feel like it is just trying to be a normal comp like Joe suggests?
I think probably it's just, I almost wish they had named it something else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they had used a different name, I think we wouldn't compare it as much to the first one. Because I think, you know, with this image, you know, I don't know what the pitcher plant, you know, eating the bug could really have to, you know, it's definitely not the statement of the first one. You know, the first one, it's pretty on the nose, and you know, there's no symbolism really. You know, you know what you're getting, which is perfect for what they're doing here. I mean, it's either just a nice image or it is some sort of, you know, it's definitely like more, you know, obscured of a thing. So I think like you unfairly like get those two put together because of the name. And I get it. It became like this series. And, you know, again, it's maybe hindsight. You know, they maybe didn't really think they would change the world, you know, like they really did with artificial intelligence, you know, despite like what Sean was saying and stuff, you know, that sort of reads as cocky, you know, early, you know, 20s bravado sort of thing. I doubt they, you know, legitimately believed it, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. It's just weird because, yeah, the first one has this like mission statement, and then all the albums in the series are also like very forward thinking records. You know what I mean? Like think about like, Incunabula doesn't like say anything on its cover, you know, about what music ought to look like. It just does it. Just shows
exactly,
you, you know what
yeah.
I mean? Like what, like what the future of music should look like. And a lot of these records do that. This one just feels to have like no aims. And I just find myself wondering like what was this for? I guess it's kind of nice to like put a little capstone on the series. I like that idea a lot. It kind of like just puts a bow on it. But a lot of the artists here were on the first comp, and presumably, I don't know, we're exposed to like a much bigger audience through that comp and through the records that they had put out the previous year. You know, some are like, you know, like Richard H. Kirk is like from Cabaret Voltaire, which are kind of like legends in electronic music. So like, does he need promoting? You know what I mean? Like a couple are a little more obscure, like people I haven't really heard of, but you know what I mean? It's like you think, okay, is it trying to show like we showed the future last time? Here's the next future, or here's the next class of electronic artists. It's not really doing that. You know what I mean? It's almost like the same thing again.
No, exactly. Yeah, I definitely don't think it's really like showing the next class. I think things like, you know, Richard Kirk, like he doesn't need the promotion. You know, I think that's maybe just like a fun, you know, nod to the, you know, you've got this, you know, Titan or whatever. It's a nod, you know, giving his blessings to the label or some kind of thing. You know, and those sort of things are like what makes these kind of compilations fun. You know, if you're a huge like Cabaret Voltaire fan, or I mean like what we're doing with Autechre, you know, it makes you like sort of go back and discover these things. I think you're right in that it works as a nice capstone, and I like that idea. But yeah, I mean this one just sort of feels like that sampler sort of thing more than a comp, you know, kind of thing. And maybe it's because maybe the first one was sort of also supposed to be that, and it just took on this historical, you know, importance.
Yeah.
But never was intended to. So I'm not sure.
Because I agree with listener Joe that it feels more like a normal comp, but then if you look at the artists here, it's like, well, then why are they here? Like, well, you don't need to promote Autechre anymore.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Now everybody knows them, you know? They dropped like a critically acclaimed classic last year or whatever. So it's like, stuff like that just makes me feel like, well, then what the hell is this?
I mean, maybe it's you know, because Autechre released a critically acclaimed thing, you'll look at this and you'll say, oh, there's an Autechre song I don't know. I liked them. Maybe I'll check out these other, you know, maybe it's a way to like sort of promote these people that are less known. But again, why use these like, pseudonyms?
Yeah, then there's the pseudonym problem. But I would think that, but then there's like a bunch of artists that presumably just put out like pretty successful records,
true,
I would guess. So it's like kind of, I don't know, just kind of seems kind of strange. Now, how would you describe the overall sound of AI2 in comparison with AI1?
You know, this one's definitely, you know, much more of like a grab bag. And really, I mean, like Pitchfork said, just sort of more generic, you know, whereas AI1 had this, you know, forward-thinking, you know, revolutionary sort of thing for at least the first half of the record. This one just sort of, this one feels like almost you could put it on shuffle and get the same kind of thing. You know, it's we're in that same world, you know, we're definitely in that, you know, electronic listening music world, but it's just not as exciting because it's an established thing by now, even though we're only 2 years later. You know, we've had this slew of classic records and things, and even things like Bjork, you know, that are sort of outside of that world, but yeah, inspired by it. You know, we've already sort of had that, you know, that right, step, you know, like the Radiohead copy and Autechre sort of, you know, we've already had that impact other artists and in the pop world and outside and stuff. So, you know, this one just really has none of that punch.
Yeah. I think what's weird about this is that, like, let's say you read about Artificial Intelligence 1 and you thought that sounds pretentious as hell. I think I would be to feel that way. You know, again, we talked about it enough, but it's like when you hear it, you hear that it's actually like really fun and there's a lot of energy and like just excitement about the possibilities, you know, but it sounds like it's really pretentious. Like this is like music you used to have fun to, but stop having fun. Listen closely. You know what I mean? Like it kind of feels like that. If you just read that description, I feel like you would imagine the sound of this record and not AI One, because this record is not really fun at all. It's like every song is really long. First off, this thing is like quite a long record. Every song is so fucking long and takes so long to start. Like every song is like a 3 minute intro, and there's just so much like big cosmic like pads, you know what I mean, like with like this phaser on it that's just like, you know, like tons of that. There are tons of, it's funny to think about the first compilation, which has kind of that like choir synth effect on the Speedy J Deorbit track and on the last Dr. Alex Patterson track, but they're like kind of chopped up and like layered in a cool way. There are so many songs on this record that have that like choir effect just to make it like big and grand and lush. And it's weird because I hear people say that, like even Pitchfork says this, that it has more diversity of sounds. I hear like very little diversity, like to the point where, and I'm not like criticizing, we'll talk about it in detail, but like Autechre's Chatter even goes ambient techno, like more ambient techno than Autechre ever gets. This is like almost purely an ambient techno record, you know, emphasis on the ambient.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely correct.
Yeah. Well, do you hear, I guess the one thing I wanted to ask before we do get into those tracks is, like that same celebration of technology we talked about with AI One, or do you feel like a different mood, you know, like a different theme here?
Yeah, I don't think I hear it quite as much. I mean, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, you know, there's definitely like this improvement of like sound quality and stuff. And maybe that's in a bit a celebration of technology. You know, it seems like there's digital things are becoming, you know, more and more, accessible and whatnot. But other than that, yeah, it sort of seems like a different mood. In fact, I liked what you said about like, if you just read about AI One, you would sort of imagine what you actually get in AI Two, which I think is a completely different mood, and theme than the first record.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel like a celebration of any kind. It doesn't feel like inviting. It feels like a little pretentious, like a little haughty, like, you know, they're these huge, like really pretentious intros and stuff to every track. And
yeah,
I don't know. It just doesn't have that same like kind of spirit. I wonder if the mood of the 90s had already soured by 94 for some reason. But let's spend a little extra time on that Autechre track again. This time it's just one, Chatter. There wasn't much consensus from our listeners on this one. Listener Espen wrote, on the second comp, Autechre deliver one of their best tunes from the early era. Chatter, together with Amber, opened up the Autechre world to me, and it will always have a special place. It's hard to describe the tune, but it was mind-blowing back in 94, and it still is. Perfection is a good description. Similarly, listener Wendell wrote, I like Chatter more than Incunabula since it elicits something in me the album doesn't, by discarding melodic content in favor of textural, tonal, and gestural focus. Meanwhile, listener Joe says that Chatter has the same sound design and effects from Anti and Amber, but has much more of a structure of a traditional acid techno track. It's not an obvious highlight, but that's because the comp is pretty solid as a whole. And listener Steve writes, unfortunately, I think this may be one of the weakest tracks on the album. It's not bad, but it's mostly focused on endless acidy loops. I love the square wave sound that drifts in, but overall the track feels fairly uninspired. So what do you think about Chatter?
You know, I think it sort of lies somewhere in between what the listeners said. You know, I tend to lean towards Steve a little bit more here. I don't really think it's like the weakest track on the record, but I do think that it is kind of overly focused on those endless acidy loops, like he said. It is definitely the most like ambient techno kind of thing that they've done up until this point, and maybe for their career, which is, it's not necessarily bad. It's just I go to Odd Tekker for like that boundary pushing, not for the thing I've already kind of heard elsewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting because it doesn't like stand out so much on the record because it really does lean into that same ambient techno mood that like every other track is on. And yet, if you're like a big Odd Tekker fan, again, this is like a hindsight thing, but like it's kind of cool to hear them do that. You know, like you kind of say, like it wouldn't be cool, I think, in 1994 at all because like so many artists were doing this, but like
you're a big Odd Tekker fan. Hindsight, yeah.
Yeah, it's like cool to go back and hear. I will say, though, that I kind of like agree with listener Wendell here. You know, he said that like it discards melodic content in favor of textural, tonal, and gestural focus. I think that is like a really cool aspect of this track. It has almost no melody, and it's really, yeah, there's some like maybe typical like kind of acid gurgling running through the whole thing, but it uses like kind of hissing glitchiness as like a hi-hat kind of thing. It's got this strange like record skipping sound running through the whole thing. Everything's sort of drenched in reverb and stuff, but it just kind of really focuses on the sound. You know, we talk about this so much about like how we love like Odd Tekker's sound design, and it's like an ambient techno track that is all about like the sheer sound. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's not like so much a there's almost no melody. There's no like composition. It's just like an arrangement of like interesting sounds. And for that, I'm kind of like impressed with it.
I guess when you sort of sold it to me boosted it up a little bit in my eyes. But I definitely think that is true. And again, hindsight, word of the day. But hints, at Odd Tekker's future a little bit, maybe not in exactly the sound, but like you said, like that the design of sound.
Yeah And I just love like there's like this weird plucky harpsichord motif thing that like kind of starts each bar later on in the track, and it's cool how, like the percussion drops out, and then like just when it drops back in, I don't know, there's just like something like super menacing, but like I start to hear like the kind of cold industrial evil of like Tri-Repetae or something, like that kind of like imposing like menace of humanlessness or something. Like I started to hear like a little bit of that, just enough for like a cool ambient techno track. I honestly kind of like, I would slightly prefer it over Crystal, if I'm being honest. I think it's like kind of a cool track. Now listener Joe also says, I feel like it would be totally out of place on Incunabula, Amber, or Anti, but it works very well on this hodgepodge of a compilation. I guess we sort of already touched on it, but do you think Chatter really does stand out from like all of AE's other work?
Yeah, a bit. I agree. I don't think it fits on any of those, two albums or one EP at all. So it is like sort of the perfect thing to throw on one of these compilations instead of just, it's something nobody ever hears, I think it does work better here than it would on any of those records.
Honestly, it kind of sounds like, Kalpel Intro, the first track on Incunabula. Like if they turned that into an ambient techno track, it's kind of just like a bubbling intro for the album. But I feel like that's the closest thing. And I don't know. It is just kind of unique and cool. Now, what non-Odd Tekker tracks do you really like here and why? I guess I should quiz you real quick. There is there's one bolded track, and then there's another one that is a 4.0. Not bolded, but those would be the two highest. Can you guess them?
I'll guess Odd Tekker.
Yes,
they're famous.
That is the bolded.
That's
one.
That's the bolded
that
one.
That is the bolded one.
The other one, maybe Speedy J again.
Nope, it's actually Link Arcadian. That's the global communication one. But what are your standouts on this comp?
Okay, well that is my big standout is the Link, the Arcadia, okay. Arcadian. I
should have gone with your gut.
Yeah, I should have. I yeah, I know. I do it and it's wrong. I don't do it. It's wrong.
Yeah.
I can't win. This song, it's just like it's a nice groove. It's 9.5 minutes. It is the longest song here, but unlike on the previous record, it doesn't overstay its welcome at all. Like I think it uses that 9.5 minutes very well. To be honest, I didn't really even notice it was 9.5 minutes until I'm looking at the track list right now. It's got sort of like a Boards of Canada sort of feel to it, you know.
Yes,
like a trip hop kind of thing. I love like the effect that's on that's the snare drum. I don't know. It's like a real short,
springy,
springy, like sort of real short delay kind of thing. It's a really good track.
Yeah, I think his track is like absolutely brilliant. I think it's probably my favorite on the whole thing. I love Global Communication in general, and I think what makes this work is that it, you know, Global Communication is just as good at the ambient as they are at the beat drop side of things. Mm-hmm. And so this track has like a huge intro again, but you are like totally sucked in because it's like absolutely gorgeous, like all of these kind of, you know, just these walls of like synth wash and this kind of like brilliant string melody. You've got like, they're always doing this like amazing kind of just beaming electric piano, like electric keyboard work that sounds like played almost. And the bass is almost like even kind of like soloing over it until like before the beat drops. And so like, you know, you get this like beat, which you're right. I think it's like very Boards of Canada. It's interesting because this record is so ambient techno. And we talked about like the hip hop influence on the first record. This is like the first track on this record, one of the few that has like a very clear hip hop influence to the way the beat is constructed. But it also has like almost a kraut rocky kind of chug to it, the way like I could just listen to this beat go forever. You know, I just love it.
Yeah, it definitely.
But I think that's the key, is just that like when it kind of does like the typical trick of every track on this record, where it's just kind of like spacious ambience, beat drop for a while, spacious ambience breakdown, beat drop again, and yet they just are so good at both sides of that coin. You know, there's so many tracks here where it just feels like wasted time when the beat is like not there, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I think it does show, you know, their mastery of this type of music. Yeah.
Was there anything else you were going to shout out as a highlight?
I liked Utuba, I think it's pronounced.
Me too.
Beaumont Hannah. It's just, you know, it's got that spacey, you know, ambient sort of feel, but when, you know, it's got a groove to it, and it's just, you know, it's super laid back. I really love the kick pattern, drum pattern in it. It's kind of a kraut rocky thing. I like that. Those two were my biggest highlights.
Yeah, I love that one as well. I think like it's really, really cool, like clean and crisp drums, and then most of the melodic content is like this weird octave note that's like kind of bending, and it's like it's got that cool like play with time thing that I like so much about AI1, because it's like the beat is so clean and crisp and like on point, and then this like woozy bending octave bass thing is like, you know what I mean, you start to think like, oh, it's not gonna make it in time. Oh, okay. It's like just bending like a little slower, a little out of time, and like just kind of grooving, and like it still somehow all kind of comes together. I think that is like such a great track. And got to shout out C Feels Spangle. I think this is another track that's like just a perfect closer. It could be the perfect closer to any album, but very, very cool. Like kind of, it's got like almost like Autechre's Flutter style, like instant classic status, where it's just like such a simple, but like immediately striking, like pretty melody with like this kind of blown out keyboard sound, like almost a lo-fi thing, and then you get like more layers of that, and the drums stay very sparse and minimal throughout, and you just kind of hear like these like lovely tinkling melodies like kind of interweaving with each other. I think that's like also a masterpiece. Now listener Steve shared comments on every track here again, including the bonus tracks we're skipping for now, sadly, but it sounds like his favorites are Speedy J's Symmetry and Belial, aka the Black Dog's Parasite. Listeners Espen and Wendell both shouted out Cefeel Spangle, and Wendell mentions being very impressed by the fact that Cefeel were an actual band that played things live. And listeners Joe and Tyler both shout out Speedy J's Symmetry and lament that he never rose to the same prominence as some of the other IDM greats, since it seems like he had so much potential. Thoughts on any of these? I kind of wanted to ask you specifically about Speedy J's Symmetry, which is like a really interesting, again, in the style of like Phil 3 or whatever it was called from AI1. It's like a almost throwback, like modular synth piece. It kind of reminds me of like Caitlin Aurelia Smith or something, like just this. Mm-hmm. But my problem with it is that like it starts to build, like the strings build and swell, and you just feel like this thing is going to crescendo and explode, and it just it just doesn't. It just like sort of drifts away. You know what I mean? It's like almost like a wasted potential thing. I know not every song has to have like a drop. You know, I don't want people to think I'm a super pleb, but it just is like building so heavy. But I do kind of like it, you know?
Yeah, I like it. It does have that sort of like West Coast synthesis feel, you know, like Buchla or something, you know, that real bubbly, you know, like Caitlin Aurelia Smith and all. I like it. It just sort of... you know, it's not one of my favorite. Like, I don't think it's a huge standout. I think it's a it's a nice piece. I definitely like it. You know, it's maybe my third or fourth, maybe fifth favorite. You know, here, but it's definitely in the you know, in the top.
Yeah, yeah. I also do like you know, one of the listeners mentioned "Parasite" by Belial, aka the Black Dog, basically. It's not one of my favorites, but it's just like a really interesting one. You know, it's so weird because I was kind of going down like the Black Dog rabbit hole these past weeks, you know. I was just like sort of listening to them again. I hadn't listened to them in a while, and like that record Spanners from 1995, the following year, is like, they call it what do they call it, Egyptronica, because it's got like an Egyptian theme to it and kind of weird like Middle Eastern type sounds to it. And this track like has that shit all over it. It's like, you could almost say it's like offensive or something, but it's got like this weird like Middle Eastern like kind of like horns and flutes and stuff, like, I don't know, mixed into this like acid-y techno like track. It's like just kind of like a fascinating thing. And I did kind of want to bring that up because there's also on this record a huge fourth world kind of influence. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of like the first two tracks, like especially, but all over this, there's like a lot of tom work and a lot of hand percussion type samples and stuff. You know what I mean? And like the fourth world thing, rest in peace to John Hassell, by the way, who passed away pretty recently, but like, it didn't age so well. It's a little problematic. You know what I mean? Like this kind of tribal, like jungly thing. That's all over this record.
Yeah, it is. I was sort of thinking about that a little bit. Yeah, maybe you know, that maybe shows its age a little bit. You know, it's definitely got a little bit of a problematic feel.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this earlier, but I thought I should just bring it up again in the context of this record. But like, you know, what do you think about the experience of listening to all these artists on a level playing field? You know, like in 1994, nobody knew that Autechre would become Autechre. They might have bet all their chips on Speedy J. You know what I mean? So like, having gotten through these first two compilations, who would you be betting on?
I mean, that's basically impossible, you know, because like, I'll say Autechre, but it's, you know, I've heard every Autechre album, you know, up until 2021 at this point.
Yeah.
So it's so hard. I mean... obviously, you know, the songs I like here, I would, you know, bet on those. But then, you know, I like Arcadian by Link, but then Link's not even the real person, you know, it's a Global Communications or whatever. So I don't know how I would know that without the internet, you know, in 1994.
That's true.
So yeah. I'd probably bet on somebody who's, you know, I'd bet on the Dice Man.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's just something interesting to ponder because it's just like, I don't know, things really went in like interesting ways.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. There's certain people here that just like dropped off, like just vanished, you know, like never really delivered. And it's just like sad to think like only a few of these artists kind of stuck around. But sort of on that note, is there anything you really don't like here? And let me quiz you once again. There's really three tracks that are lower than anything else. I wonder if you can guess one of those three.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say the first one, Mark Franklin.
Close. But actually the second one, the Higher Intelligence Agency, Richard H. Kirk's track, and the Belial track actually are the three lowest rated. What are the ones that you don't like here?
It speaks to, you know, this compilation a little bit that, you know, on the first one, I had two, you know, obvious tracks that I disliked. I don't think here, I don't like hate anything. That first track is sort of my least favorite. It's got like a real sounding bass.
Yeah, it does.
And it just, and like,
I wanted to read, by the way, that one of our listeners, Steve, was talking about that track, Mark Franklin's release to the system, and said, I think the vocals / samples are a big part of this track, so I'm sure Dan will hate it.
Yeah, that's the other part. Is I do.
What is she saying? Feel strange, beautiful.
Yeah,
strange,
it's just
beautiful.
it just, you know, if it happened like a little bit, it would probably be okay. Because I think like, when it first comes in, it's not that bad, but it just goes on and on and on. Yeah. And it, the sample overstays its welcome. But really, that that bass sound just really sort of bugs me. It's like a, I don't know if it's a real bass or if it's maybe synthesized, but I don't know. It just sort of sounds outdated and out of place, you know, on this record, on this series, and even just in the song itself. So I think that, you know, that's my the one I dislike the least, but I don't hate it. Definitely don't hate it as much as I hate you know, those two on the first one.
Yeah, I'll say that for me, the first two tracks here are like really a problem, and it sort of like drags down the rest of the record, which, you know, as you kind of mentioned, is like, you know, fine. It's like pretty good sometimes, mm-hmm. and then mostly just fine. But it's like, it starts off with, you know, two long tracks, as every track is here, that I think are just like, sort of like pointless. They're like the worst case of what I was describing earlier when I was kind of making fun of this as being like, you know, kind of fourth worldy, nothing but like tabla and hand percussion plus big synth washes, you know, mm-hmm. very new agey. Both of these tracks have that. I do think that like vocal sample on the first track is like quite corny, but I just think these two tracks are like very, very generic, like very regular. And then we go on like a nice stretch of pretty cool tracks. We talked about Lynx Arcadian. B12 Scriptures, I think, is like kind of shitty for the first half. And then you get like a straight up 4/4 kick and like traditional claps on the 2 and the 4. And all of a sudden the whole track is like a banger. Like I like love the second half of the track a lot. You know, I mentioned liking Symmetry, thinking, you know, it's not a masterpiece, but it's great. And I think Beaumont Hanan is good. You know, the Richard H. Kirk track, I think, is like a weirdly, I don't know, just like a weirdly kind of like primitive. It has that same problem I was complaining about with the egg, where it's just like, I'll do this sound for a little while over the loop. Now I'll do this sound for a little while over the loop. And, you know, definitely a low light for me, but it just feels like, you know, and then like I mentioned, like the last two tracks I think are kind of cool. Even if like Parasite isn't like the best thing ever, it's kind of interesting. So
yeah,
it feels like a fine record that like for me gets off to a really bad start for the most part.
Yeah, I think, you know, it also doesn't help that, like, I mean, all the songs here are long, but
yeah,
those two up front, they take so long to do anything, if, you know, and if they do anything is you know, a matter of debate, I guess. But yeah, I would agree. The Selenite is another one, you know, that I don't love. Whereas the first compilation, you know, the first half was the best, and it got, I think, got off to a great start. You know, this one sort of does the opposite. And it gets better in the middle.
And it can't like recover almost. Like it got off to such a bad start, I think, that and the tracks like aren't great enough for the most part, like except for, you know, besides a few exceptions where you just kind of feel like it was just okay, even though it was mm-hmm. mostly like bad and then pretty good.
No, exactly. I mean, especially because, you know, we're talking about getting off to a slow start here, but also that slow start is 15 minutes of the record,
yeah.
You know?
Really slow start.
So, yeah. And then you're right. You know, nothing here is really like the best song ever. You got to hear it. You know, everything just sort of lands on this, you know, okay to pretty good, you know, sort of thing. And it makes it tough to get past two of the okay ones before you get to the pretty good one.
Yeah. Well, we didn't get many lowlights from listeners, and I get the impression that most people kind of think this comp is all at the same decent level, which might actually be a pretty strong indictment of the record's overall quality, you know. And indeed, pretty much everybody who wrote in said that AI2 is not as good as AI1. On the other hand, though, listener Tyler felt that AI2 is weaker than the first overall, despite having higher highs, Symmetry, Chatter, Spangle, than the first compilation. Do you agree with that? It's got higher highs?
No, not really. You know, Spangle is a good track and stuff, but I don't think the highs here are, I mean, it's basically what we were just talking about. The highs here aren't that much higher than the lows. It's just, I mean, it's pretty much a flat, you know, even kind of record, which on something like this is an indictment of it. And yeah, I don't think, whereas the lows are definitely lower on AI1, that the highs there are definitely higher, and make it worth, you know, dealing with those couple lows on the first one. Here it's just sort of, you know, that range is so narrow from like not that great to okay, you know, pretty good sort of thing. You know, everything's like within a few points of each other, I would think.
Yeah, I kind of agree, but like on paper, I would say that Lynx Arcadian and Cefeel's Spangle are like classics, like masterpieces, but they don't feel like it in the record.
No,
like
no, exactly.
Just dragged down. You know, if you listen to them on their own, I think they'd be even more impressive. As far, I want to ask about the sequencing real quick, and if this one plays like a proper album, I feel like there was no attempt to even sequence this. I think you kind of already said it, but it's just like, it stays at the same tempo, the same vibe, the same level the entire time. You know, the first one, despite stumbling, it at least tries to kind of like hit you with like a banger right away. It kind of slows things down with the next couple tracks. It kind of like kicks it way back up again, and then it drops like way, way down. It had like an arc. This has just no arc to me.
Nah, this one, again, feels like the sampler sort of thing, you know? I feel like, you know, most of those kind of things, you could put them on shuffle, doesn't change anything about it. Here, I think the same kind of way, you know, putting on a shuffle might actually help it, because you wouldn't always end up, you know, with the slog up front. But yeah, it just really, it definitely doesn't seem like as much attention was paid. I mean, maybe they just got lucky on the first one and there was equal attention paid. But yeah, this one has that sample feel, you know, much deeper embedded into it.
Yeah, well, we already read almost this exact take from another listener, but I think we ought to discuss it quickly again in regards to AI2. Listener Tyler writes, I'm only 26, so I wasn't even alive when this series started and didn't hear it until I was in my mid-teens. I really wish that I had the perspective of a listener at that time, because many of the ideas in these compilations feel dated now, but I'm sure they were groundbreaking at the time, and that part of their generic feel comes from how much was spawned by them. So, you know, the question of how well has this comp aged? Do you think it's aged better or worse than AI1?
I think maybe worse, in the sense that, like, it does feel sort of generic. You know, nothing here really sounds like really like maybe out and out outdated. It's just by this point, as so many of these people have released, you know, classic records, that it almost feels like redundant more than outdated. So it definitely, you know, doesn't feel, you know, groundbreaking. But I mean, you know, I was alive, but I was, you know, not very old. I was 7 at the time, so I wasn't listening to Warp Records. But, you know, I don't feel like this would blow my mind or anything, because I think if I was listening to AI2, I probably would have listened to, you know, Incunabula or Bites or so. You know, I probably would have heard one of these other records that I think is better and even more forward thinking than this compilation, you know, ever gets.
Yeah, that's kind of the paradox, because you would expect AI1 to age worse, not only because it's older, but also because a big part of the appeal is that it's like groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And so when it no longer sounds groundbreaking, it shouldn't be as good. And this one has lower, you know, like less of a mission statement and stuff. It's just meant to be some good music. You would think that would age better. And yet, ironically, it like ages a lot worse. There's not really a historical reason to check this out, because it was sort of made redundant, like you said, by all the releases that are around it. And it's also just like, you know, I mentioned the Fourth World stuff sounding kind of dated at this point, and just like the really long, like almost pretentious, like kind of ambience to it and everything. To me, it just, I don't know, there's something like fun, and it still has, the AI1 still has that kind of like excitement of like, whoa, this is a cool new thing happening in front of my ears, and this just totally lacks that. You know, here's another interesting comment from listener Joe, actually, who writes, much is made about how artificial intelligence was electronic listening music in contrast to dance music, but I wonder if dance music in general ages more gracefully than listening music. For example, my daughters love dancing to cheesy 80s and 90s songs like the Macarena and Living in a Box, even though the music itself is extremely dated when you listen closely. Since dance music is meant to be felt and danced to instead of listened to carefully, do you think it ages better over time by default? What do you think?
I don't think it ages better. I mean, things like the Macarena, it's like, you know, there's some irony in it. you know, it's like there's nostalgia, there's irony. You know, I don't think anybody ever thought Macarena was a good song. It's just like, I don't know, there was something in the 90s. People loved coordinated dance that like went with a track, you know.
You love novelty songs in the 90s.
Exactly, like, you know, you think of, I don't go to a lot of weddings, but I feel like still today. You're hearing those sure. same, God, you know, like, sure. when's the last new novelty song come out?
They're done. 9/11 killed the novelty song. That's my long-running theory.
Yeah.
You could no longer really have fun anymore. Totally.
Yeah, I don't think you've ever talked about that on this podcast. but that is... It's legitimately one of your better crazy conspiracy theories.
I think it's true, but I will qualify it by saying I think that, like, not that I love this, but like the Lonely Island brought back the novelty song. It could not, it was too sad of a time in the early 2000s to have a novelty song. And then it was like 2007 or 8 or something when finally, like, Dick in a Box and I'm
You're allowed.
Whatever those songs are.
You were allowed to laugh.
You know, thank God. Thank God. God bless the Lonely Island. You know, I mean, to this question, I just wanted to say, like, the problem is, I think it's true that, like, bodily, like, stuff that, like, moves your body is never going to age. Like, it's always going to, mm-hmm. it's always going to slap, kind of. But the problem is, like, when are you dancing to this? Like, I understand that some, you know, you go to an 80s night or something, and there are some songs that, like, you always kind of hear and you always get a chance to dance to. But the problem is that, like, when it comes to early electronic music, no DJs are, like, slipping these tracks into their sets anymore. You know, they just aren't. And so you're never hearing it in a club. You're only hearing it at home.
Yeah.
Almost everything mm-hmm. obeys this rule. You know what I mean? Like, there's a time when it's played in the clubs, and then forever from then on, you can listen to it at your home if you want, and that's it. And so the problem with that is, like, really great dance tunes, I think, age sometimes horribly because you never... You know what? We talk about this all the time. Like, if Cavity Job played in a club, I would probably have a great time, but I will never get to experience that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Never.
Exactly. No, I mean, that's true because you're right. You know, you hear Macarena at, you know, you're drunk. You hear it at an 80s or a 90s night. Yeah, it's fun. Everybody knows. I still know the stupid ass little dance and stuff. You know, it is fun. But yeah, I mean, at home, am I ever going to throw Macarena on? Like, no, definitely not. It would suck. I mean, not that it doesn't suck normally, but the fun of it is the community. I don't know that living in a box. I don't think I know that. At least off the top of my head. But you know, just those things. Like I was talking about all those dance things that were on those CDs. You know that stuff. Like if you're home by yourself and listen to any of those, they're awful. But yeah,
yeah.
You hear them in the club. You hear them, you know, at a house party. Maybe even you're drunk. You're gonna have that. You'll have that like visceral reaction to it.
So it's an interesting question because in some ways dance music does have the edge, but it also is like at a great disadvantage because mm-hmm. you never will get a chance to actually just move to a lot of these classic dance tracks. Now, as we wrap up, and I promise we are wrapping up, and it was a very, very long episode. We had so many listener emails this time, and people are like really, really interested in this, which I'm really thrilled about. But as we wrap up, I want to note that several listeners shared thoughts on other albums from the Artificial Intelligence series. Listener Joe, for example, shared detailed comments on all of them. I think what we'll have to do is save some of these comments and questions for our next listener email episode. We'll talk about all these, but I wanted to read this from listener Joe, who says that the series as a whole is essential listening and writes, "I think that even in 2021, anyone who wants to get deeper into electronic music definitely needs to listen to at the very least the first AI compilation, but that it's absolutely worth going through the entire series and seeing how electronic music developed between 1992 and 1994. I wouldn't say that each album is essential on its own, and there are other essential albums from the period that aren't included in the series, but in the same way that LSEC is much greater than the sum of its parts, the AI series is all in all a definitive collaborative work from the early 90s electronic music scene that covers so many different styles, ideas, aesthetics, approaches, and possibilities." What do you think about that? And do you just have any like quick thoughts? Again, we'll talk about it more in the future on any of the other albums in the Artificial Intelligence series.
Well, I like what he said. You know, I think one, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably into like music and music history enough to like want to, you know, go through it as like all those records, you know, as historical documents. And I think that, you know, I personally love doing that kind of thing. So I think it's worthwhile. And I agree with Joe. As for thoughts on those records, you know, I purposely sort of avoided, or not sort of, I did avoid listening to any of those other ones, except for these two, comps over the week, just as I never want to like confuse myself as to what's on what, especially since some of these songs are on both things, and then also you know I just want to sort of look at them in isolation, So it's been a while since I've listened to, you know, most of them other than Incunabula. But, you know, I have always liked, you know, surfing on sine waves, and I like Black Dog quite a bit and stuff. But I definitely, like, in doing this, I've been wanting to, you know, go back and listen to all those records. And then, you know, we kept pushing it back, the episode back, you know, added another week. Yeah. And it sort of like was, you know, making me chop at the bit a little bit more for it. So I personally am excited to do that myself.
Yeah, I think we'll do it. We'll just like refresh a little bit on some of these, and we'll talk about it a little bit more on next week's bonus mm-hmm. episode. But I, you know, broke the rule. I listened to all of them a bunch of times over the course of these 3 weeks rather. And I think it is an amazing collection. I agree with Joe 100%. Like, you should really like check out this series. And honestly, you could just skip the compilations and just listen to these records. Like, you would miss some stuff, obviously, but like, they are such an amazing representation of like all the exciting possibilities and like things that were changing at this time in electronic music. I mean, Incunabula is an obvious classic. I always kind of felt like Polygon Window was like, I don't know, not as good as I want it to be, but Bites, I will say, I just adore. Like, all these mm-hmm. these past 3 weeks, I was like listening to it a lot, because I think it's just such a great record. And it's just so funny, we'll talk about it again next time, but like, Joe was talking about like revisiting Bites and feeling like totally underwhelmed by it, and I had the exact opposite experience, where I like always thought it was okay, and then I listened to it, you know, this past week, and I was like, damn, I fucking love this record. But all the records here are good. And I just agree that like, as a series, this is just like a monumental accomplishment. None of them are like the masterpieces of their respective year necessarily, but like, as a whole, the whole series is like such an accomplishment. One more big picture question from listener Joe, who says, it's a shame that they didn't continue releasing artificial intelligence compilations every other year to showcase whatever the best electronic music on the label was at the time. Imagine how we could be getting ready for Artificial Intelligence 16 to be released next year and wondering who would be featured on it. It'd also be really cool for archival purposes to be able to look back on Artificial Intelligence 9 and have a sample of what electronic music sounded like in 2008. What do you think? Is it a shame we haven't gotten artificial intelligence compilations all these years?
I mean, I think after a certain point, it'd become unnecessary and maybe, you know, lose its luster.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it'd be cool, and it'd be an easy way to, like, you know, a easy like little snapshot to look back at, you know, like you said, like, you know, look at 2008, you know, just look at, you know, Artificial Intelligence, you know, 9 or whatever. Like, it yeah. would, again, it would be nice from like a document standpoint. But I think, you know, I think AI 2 proves that
yeah,
we should have maybe
it had run its course by the second one.
We should have maybe stopped at AI 1. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like, I mean, on paper, this sounds like really fun. It would be really cool to have. But then it's like, I'd listen to AI 2 and I'm like, this didn't need to.
Yeah. We could have already stopped.
So one last thing I've got to mention, several listeners talked about this video album that Warp put out around this time, sort of a crude and like bizarre CGI put to various tracks from both Comps and Beyond. I think Bass Cadet is on there. I think we'll have to talk about that on our next listener episode as well. We're already running long here, as you can tell, but I definitely do want to talk about that soon, as well as some of the other records in the series in a little bit more depth. So do keep an eye out for next week's episode. But okay, we've reached a finish line. Any other closing thoughts on Artificial Intelligence or Artificial Intelligence 2? Dan, maybe you can give a final verdict on, you know, if people have not heard these comps yet, should they seek them out, or at this point just skip them?
I think you should listen to the first one. The theme of the show is it's been that it's a fine historical document. If you're listening to this podcast, you're interested enough in electronic music that you'll find something interesting in it. You know, even if it's not you know, the best music you've ever heard or the best, you know, songs from these artists. You know, two. You can skip too, I think. You know, it's just sort of run its course by then. You know, you'd have a better time listening to any of, you know, those classic records that come out around that compilation. You get a better view of the electronic world, I think, than you do in AI 2.
Yeah, you're not going to regret checking either of them out, I don't think. AI 1 is definitely more rewarding. But, you know, like I was just kind of saying, I feel like if you're pressed for time for some reason, like, just check out the rest of the AI series, like the albums that came out in the Artificial Intelligence series that are not the comps. like there are some like classics there. Mm-hmm. They're all just so enjoyable, and they give you a bigger and like better picture of what was going on in the early 90s and the warp scene in particular. So, you know, that would be my verdict.
All right. Well, what do you think about the artificial intelligence compilations? We're doing another listener email episode next week. So send us your thoughts, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Next proper episode in 2 weeks. Some sort of early guest comp. We'll let you know on the listener email show, hopefully. We want your opinions and hot takes, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out. Subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up. YouTube. Stay connected. Twitter, Instagram, @gonkcastpod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.